said Epitalus. "She's clean as fresh plaster." "Hmm." Locke tapped his knuckles against the map table. "Clean just means we can paint whatever we like on her. But let's not do it directly. Master Callus and I will arrange a crew, scary people on a tight leash. They'll visit some of our fence-sitters in Plaza Gandolo, and they'll make threats. Vote for Viracoy and the Black Aris, or bad things happen to your nice homes, your pretty gardens, your expensive carriages."
"Well, I don't mean to tell you your business, Master Lazari," said Epitalus, "but shouldn't we be frightening voters into our own corner?"
"I don't want them frightened. I want them annoyed. Come now, Epitalus, how would you feel if a pack of half-copperhoods barged into your foyer and tried to put a scare into you? Swells aren't used to being pushed around. They'll resent it like hell. They'll mutter about it to all their friends, and they'll be at the head of the line to vote against the Black Aris out of spite."
"Bye-bye," said Epitalus. "There may be something in that. And what about Juvindus?"
"I'll come up with something suitable for him, too. Let the pot simmer a while." Locke tapped the side of his head. "Where's Nikoros?"
"Coming, sirs, coming!"
Long black plate bobbing behind him, Nikoros jogged up the gallery stairs and passed a set of papers to Jean.
"Fresh as the weather, all the reports you asked for, and something, unfortunate."
"Unfortunate?"
Jean flipped through the papers until he found one that caught his eye. The furrows in his forehead deepened as he read, and when he finished he drew Locke aside.
"What is it?"
"The official constabulary report on the arrest of Fifth Son Lucidus of the Issas Merrow," said Jean.
"What?" "It says that acting on a tip from the Lashani Legate, a party of constables paid Lucidus a visit and discovered a team of stolen Lashani carriage horses in his private stable, identifiable by their brands." "Cockless sons of Jeremite shit jugglers!"
Locke seized the report and scanned it.
"That sneaky bitch. That beautiful, sneaky bitch. She just can't let us feel good about ourselves, not even for a few days. Oh, look, out of concern for the diplomatic aspect of the situation, they're holding Lucidus in solitary confinement until after the election."
"Indeed."
"Some of the Black Aris chicks must have complained to their mother hen about the big bad debt collector. So much for that scheme."
"We should come back hard and fast."
"Agreed." Locke closed his eyes and took several deep breaths. "Keep pushing everyone on that list of vulnerabilities. Send courtesans and handsome lads after all the Black Aris people with wandering eyes. Make sure the gamblers get invitations to high-stakes games. Scatter temptations all around the ones with nasty habits. Pluck the weaknesses of the flesh like harp strings, all of them, from every direction."
"I suppose there's money in the bank itching to be spent," sighed Jean.
"That's right. We'll spend it down to the dust under the last scrap of copper. Then we'll sweep up the dust and see what we can get for it."
One thing more, sirs," said Nikoros. "Justin tells me that we've got watchers on the surrounding rooftops again."
"Leave that with me," said Jean. "We gave fair warning. This time I'll make some work for the physicers."
13. Cool grey veils of drizzle and fog draped the neighbourhood when Jean went out, an hour after midnight, to pay a call on the new neighbours. He moved up to the rooftops as slowly and cautiously as possible, using routes he'd noted on the previous excursion. In this weather there were no drunks or lovers to stumble over, and he was confident that he crept along as silently as he ever had in his life. His first target was obvious, so obvious that Jean watched for nearly a quarter of an hour, straining his senses to spot the ambush or the trap that had to be there. The watcher sat, in a collapsible wooden leather chair beside a parapet, wrapped in a cloak and blanket. If not for the fact that the seated figure moved from time to time, Jean would have sworn it had to be a decoy. The tiniest speck of light lit the shadows beside the chair, revealing a spread of gear and comforts, including bottles of wine, a silk parasol, and several different spyglasses. It had to be a joke, or a trap, and yet there was simply nobody else around. He took the opening. It was child's play to sneak up behind the seated watcher and clap a hand over their mouth.
"Scream and I'll break your arms," hissed Jean.
The watcher gave a start, but it was plain in an instant that this small-framed and weak body was incapable of serious resistance. Puzzled, Jean scrabbled for the light source, which turned out to be a dark lantern with the aperture drawn to its narrowest setting. Jean eased it open another few clicks and held it up to his captive. Gods, it was an old woman, a very old woman, 70 or more, and it wasn't one of Sabatha's make-up jobs either. This woman was genuinely light and frail, her face a valley of lines, one eye grey as the overcast sky, the other one, however, fixed on him with mischievous vitality.
"Oh, hello, dear," she whispered as he withdrew his hand. "I won't be screaming, I promise. You gave me a start, though she warned me you'd be up sooner or later."
"She?"
"My employer, dear."
"So you admit that you're..."
"A spy, oh yes."
The old woman chuckled, a dry and not entirely healthy sound.
"A spyfully spying spy, settled up here all cozy to see what I can see, which isn't much, more's the pity. That's why I've got all the lovely spy-glasses. Now, what are you going to do with me, dear? Are you going to beat the hell out of me?"
"What? No!"
"Pick me up and throw me off the roof? Tie me up and leave me here for a few hours? Kick my teeth out?"
"Gods, woman, of course not."
"Oh, that's exactly what she told me," beamed the old woman. "She said you weren't the sort of fellow who'd raise his hand to a helpless old woman, which, let's be honest, is what time has made of me."
Jean lowered his head against the cold stone of the parapet and groaned.
"Oh, come now, son, it's not a thing to be ashamed of, having scruples."
"Are all of her new spies as,
old as myself? Oh, there's no harm in saying it. Yes, dear, you're hemmed in by old women, all of us wrapped up in our blankets, clutching our parasols. We've got apartments to use and people to fetch us things, but we're doing the watching from now on, unless you beat us up."
"Come now," said Jean, "you know I won't."
"Yes, I do."
"I don't suppose I could ask you very politely to get down off this roof and go away."
"Oh, gods, no. Apologies, dear, but the money I'm seeing for this, well, I don't think I can live long enough for money to ever be a problem again."
"I could make you a better deal."
"Oh, no. No, gods bless you for offering, but no. You've got your scruples and I've got mine."
"I could pick you up and carry you down to the street."
"Of course you could, and then I'd kick and scream and fuss, and you'd have to deal with that somehow. And when you were done, I'd creep back up here as fast as my joints could take me, and since you won't just punch my lights out, we'd have to do it all over again."
She punctuated these words by tapping him gently on the chest with a very slender finger.
"All over again, and again, and again."
"Well, shit."
Jean slumped against the parapet, feeling soundly embarrassed.
"Don't, come crawling to us for help if you catch an ague up here or something."
"Never fret, dear. I can assure you that we're very well looked after, just like you're in."
14. At the very moment Jean Tannen was discovering old women on rooftops, Nikoros Vialupa was knocking at a lamplit door in a misty alley behind the avenue of the night singers on the Issas Vorhala. He had a warm, nervous itch in his throat, an itch he had run out of the means to assuage. The apothecary shop of the brothers Farragher provided the alley door as a discreet courtesy for those in need at odd hours. This included customers in pursuit of substances not sanctioned by the laws of Carthane. The burly guard behind the door, wrapped in a heavy black coat, was new to Nikoros. The fellow that had always met him before had been older and thinner. The man let him in regardless, gesturing up the narrow steps with a grunt and leaving Nikoros to find his own way to the rear office. There, third son Farragher sat slumped behind a counter, threads of some floral smoke wrapped around him like a ghostly shawl, idly mixing powders on a measuring board.
"Nikoros," said the alchemist glumly,
Thought I might see you sooner rather than later. What's your taste?
You know why I'm here, said Nikoros.
Third son Farragher had always been the sole provider of Nikoros' dust, had led him to the stuff in the first place, in fact.
Muse of fire,
grunted Farragher, setting aside the glass rod he'd been using in his work.
Need some more lightning for those clouds in your head, eh?
Same as always.
Nikoros licked his lips and tried to ignore the hollow, dry sensation inside his skull. He'd meant to put off another purchase for a few days, meant to obey Lazari and Callus, but the urge had grown. An initially aimless walk had drawn him here, inevitably as water running downhill.
Akadris, said Farragher. Well, if that's what you want, let's see your coin.
Nikoros tossed a bag of silver on the counter. No sooner had it landed than something slapped him painfully in his left side. Wincing, he turned and found that the burly door guard had crept up to the office after him, lacquered wooden baton in hand. The man's bulky black coat now hung open, revealing the light constabulary blue of the jacket beneath.
This is disappointing, Vialupa. You ought to know a thing or two about the laws concerning black alchemy, said the constable with a grin. That's 10 years in a penance barge sitting there on the counter. Confiscation of your goods, forfeiture of licenses and citizenship, exile too if you live through your 10. But surely, said Nikoros, fear clawing at his innards, there must be some, mistake.
Yeah, and you're the one that made it.
I'm sorry, muttered Farragher, looking away. They got on to me last week. I had no choice. I'd be on a barge already if I hadn't agreed to help them.
Oh, gods, please, whispered Nikoros.
It was a smart arrangement, said a woman, appearing from the door behind Farragher. She wore a dark hooded cloak, the sort of thing Nikoros might have scoffed at as theatrical. Any time before the Carthani constabulary had threatened to bring his life to an end.
Third son Farragher made one that got him off the hook. You might be able to do the same.
The woman pushed her hood back, revealing long, dark red hair. Her eyes glittered as she began to explain to Nikoros what would be required of him. 15. Carthane was the most cultivated and manicured city Locke had ever seen, and the Vel Verde, the Green Terrace, was perhaps its most cultivated and manicured district. The manors and promenades of the Vel Verde were walled in by thick strands of poplar, olive, witchwood, pale oak and merinshade trees, and beyond it all loomed the crumbling shadow of the city's old walls. In any other Therin city, these would have been lit, manned, and obsessively repaired, but the Carthani hadn't kept theirs up for more than 3 centuries.
"This is a private manor, not a restaurant," said Sabatha as Locke led her up a winding black iron staircase. "If you've got some sort of half-witted ambush in mind, Master Lamora, I must warn you that I'll be severely disappointed."
"It's vacant. One of my deep-roots ladies holds it from a dead cousin. She's been lax about selling it off since she doesn't exactly need the money, but she was happy to let me borrow it for a night."
"Will I be getting a pile of snakes dropped on my head?"
Ha, no, and thank you for that, by the way. I was ever so worried about those little fellows while they were away from me. No, Mistress of Doubts, I've brought you here to this secluded corner of the city for the nefarious purpose of cooking your dinner myself. They came to the second floor of the dark, undecorated manor house, and Locke slid a wooden door in the north wall open with a dramatic flourish. Thus revealed was a tiled balcony with a marbled balustrade, overlooking the dark tops of countless trees swaying softly in the autumn breeze. Lanterns in semi-opaque paper hoods filled the area with mellow golden light.
"Ooh," said Sabatha.
She allowed Locke to pull out one of the chairs at the tiny round witchwood table in the center of the balcony for her.
"Now this is more promising."
"I didn't just choose the setting," said Locke. "Tonight I'm chef, sommelier, and alchemist in one very convenient package, and of course available at a staggeringly insignificant cost if it suits the lady."
I'm not sure I brought any coins small enough to pay an appropriate price for you.
I practice selective deafness to hurtful remarks, young woman. Though I should ask, are we under observation by one of your packs of old women?
No, not here. Much as I could have used a chaperone, they're busy where they are.
They're damned lucky it was Jean that stumbled over them. I don't have his qualms about punching old biddies in the teeth.
Well then, why haven't you vanquished them yourself?
Some forms of behavior, sighed Locke, simply cannot be made to look reasonable.
You don't say. You might have drugged them, of course.
Oh, yes, said Locke. Throwing alchemy at old women with gods know what sorts of constitutional complaints. If I can't murder them on purpose, I'd hardly let it happen by accident.
That thought had crossed my mind, said Sabitha, grinning.
Now, how's your candidate for Plaza Gandolo? Said Locke. What's her name again? Second daughter Viracoy? Got taken in by the constables on a pretty serious charge, I heard. Receiving stolen goods? Stolen goods from the houses of deep-root supporters? That's pretty shocking.
And pretty asinine, said Sabitha, feigning a deep yawn. Her solicitors will have the matter cleared up in just a day or two.
Well, no doubt you're right not to worry. After all, you've got quite a slate of replacement candidates if she should be tied up in the courts, as thrilling a collection of ciphers and non-entities as ever stirred the voters to indifference.
Now, Locke, she said softly, you and I going on like this before the final results are tallied is like peeking at festival presents before they're opened. This isn't the game I came to play tonight.
Delighted to hear it. Watch then and be amazed as I perform the most menial portion of an amazing alchemical process and claim all the credit for myself. On the table stood a silver bucket within a bucket, constructed so that there was an open gap of about a finger's width between the inner and outer walls. In the center bucket, a bottle of pale orange wine stood in water. Locke uncapped two leather-covered decanters. He poured their colorless contents into the outer channel of the chambered bucket, then juggled the empty decanters hand to hand a few times and bowed. A patina of frost appeared on the outer surface of the bucket, steadily thickening into a wall of crisp white ice. Puffs of pale vapor rose from the bucket's outer channel, and a jagged crackling noise could be heard. Locke silently counted out 15 seconds, pulled on a leather glove, and carefully tilted the bucket toward Sabitha. The wine bottle, cloudy with frost, was now immersed in slush. Behold, I have chilled the wine. I am the true master of the elements. Bonds magi across the city are handing in their resignations. Sabitha rendered applause by tapping one finger inaudibly against the opposite palm. Locke grinned, withdrew the bottle from its semi-solid surroundings, uncorked it, and poured two glasses. I give you our first toast of the evening. Locke picked up his glass and touched it gently to hers. To crime, confusion, and all arts insidious. To the most enchanting practitioner they've ever had.
That's awkward, asking me to drink to my own honor.
I'm sure a self-regard as robust as your own can easily bear the strain. They drank. The sweet orange and ginger wine was cold as a northern autumn. Locke poured them each a second glass.
My turn, said Sabitha. To strange little boys and impatient little girls, may their real mistakes be gentle and far between.
Am I wide of the mark, or are you in a better mood than you were 3 nights ago? Said Locke as he finished his second drink.
It was quite a mood, wasn't it?
Did you figure anything out?
Only that I wasn't going to find any real answers in one night of brooding. Besides, packing you off in some sort of richly deserved trap always cheers me up.
You might see those snakes again, madam, if you keep up that unseemly gloating. Now, I believe I promised you dinner.
Off to one side of the balcony was a long oak table and a smouldering brazier. Locke threw more chips of aromatic wood into the brazier and gave them a stir. Pleasantly approaching the edge of muddled as the wine mounted from his mostly empty stomach, he examined the piles of ingredients and utensils he'd set out earlier. There was a tap on his shoulder.
"Now this is not how it's done," said Sabitha. She'd removed her black velvet jacket, revealing a white silk undertunic and a loosely knotted scarf, just slightly darker than her hair. "I haven't even started cooking yet. Where we come from, we didn't cook for one another, remember? We cooked together. Well, let's see what sort of mess you've got here." She bumped him gently aside with her hip. Together they sorted out the components of the meal he'd planned. Fennel fronds, onions, sliced blood oranges, pale white olives, almonds and hazelnuts, a chicken he'd plucked and dressed, and enough assorted oils to sauté anything smaller than a horse. "How strange," she said, "but it looks as though you've assembled some of my favorite things."
"My life is haunted by wild coincidences," said Locke.
"I suppose I should admire your constancy in one respect, Locke Lamora. All these years, and you're still beside yourself to tumble a red-headed girl."
"Oh?" His grin faded, along with some of his wine-induced buoyancy. He reached out and touched a loose strand of her burnished copper hair. "You know, if you take offense at the notion, you have a hell of a strange way of showing it."
"Confusion and all art's insidious," she said, glancing away.
"Did you really restore that color just to keep me off balance? Make me easier to play games with?"
"No," she said. "Not entirely."
"Not entirely." Locke stared at her, trying to force the muscles of his face, usually so loyal and pliable, to twitch into some semblance of a smile. "You know, I hate the way one of us can say something. We're enjoying ourselves for the gods know how long, but one wrong word and suddenly it's like we're not even in the same room."
"We" is a tactful way of saying me, isn't it?
"Only this time," said Locke. "Sabitha, listen to me. You know what I'm after. My cards are on the table and always have been. Am I fixated? Yes, absolutely. Am I sorry about that? No. I'm standing here with my intentions plain as the rising sun, waiting for you to convince yourself one way or the other. And I'll wait for that. I'll wait until I'm old and bent and need help spelling my own name. But you know, if I had the luxury of any self-respect at all where you're concerned, I'd be insulted by the idea that I must think convincing you to spread your legs is the big end game."
"I'm sorry," she said. "I know. I do know you want more than that. And for all your faults, you give more..."
"Bloody right. I mean, who knows? Maybe we could sleep together twice." He drew himself up, thrust out his chest, and stuck out his tongue. "Limitless ambitions, woman! Limitless!"
"Oh, you bastard!"
She punched him, but it was the sort of punch delivered with a warm smile. "So, has it... well, how long has it been for you? Since, you know..." "You already know the answer," said Locke. "Very precisely. Think about the day you left. Go back 2 nights from that, and there you have it."
"Not even once?"
"I guess it's fucking ridiculous, isn't it? But no, I tried. I tried to enlist some help. One of the resident cherry tops at the Gilded Lilies. Turns out a redhead's just not a redhead if she's not, you know, twice as smart as I am and 3 times as infuriating."
"3 times as smart," said Sabitha. "Half as infuriating. And I am sorry."
"Don't be. It wasn't too bad." Locke rolled an onion across the table and bounced it off a decanter of olive oil. "She was a friend, close to Chains and me. She knew what my problem was, and that pushing it wasn't the answer. I got a massage that was worth the price of admission."
"I suppose I should tell you, it hasn't been the same way with me these past few years, for several reasons."
"I see." He felt cold knots forming in his guts, but fought the sensation down. "I won't lie. My feelings about you are as selfish as hell. I don't like to think about you with anyone else, but I wasn't there. You're a grown woman, and you didn't owe me anything. Did you expect me to be angry?"
"Yes.
I might have been once. Maybe the one real advantage to getting older is that you have the time to pull your head a little bit farther out of your ass. I don't want to care, understand? You're here now. With luck, I really hope you'll be here later. Besides, it seems safe to assume you weren't swept off your feet by a handsome young Vadran lord with a castle or two to spare."
I had some comfort from it once or twice. She reached out and touched his arm, not softly, as though she were afraid he might suddenly decide to be elsewhere. And the rest of the time, it was to empty some pockets, or a vault, you know.
I do indeed.
He reached out half-consciously and started fiddling with another onion, spinning it like a top. In fact, I'm steadily emptying a bank vault because of you with every passing day.
Good, because I've never been what anyone would call easy, and I'm certainly not cheap.
She reached up and took his other arm.
Sabitha, what?
I'm making a decision. Now, are you going to quit playing with that fucking onion and see what happens if you kiss me, or do I have to put a sword to your neck?
Promise I won't wake up on a ship.
Disappoint me, Lamora, and I make no promises as to where and when you'll wake up.
He put his hands beneath her arms, swung her off her feet, and lifted her onto the table. Laughing, she hooked her legs behind his waist and pulled him close. Her lips were warm and still carried the faint taste of ginger and oranges. He had no idea how long they kissed, arms around each other's necks, but while they did, Locke completely lost track of the fact that he was even standing up.
Phew,
Sabitha said when they grudgingly broke apart at last. She put a finger against his lips.
And look at that, you're still conscious. You're one and one when it comes to kissing in Carthane.
That's a tally I mean to improve.
Sabitha?
Sabitha, what is it? She'd gone rigid in his arms. With his head still spinning from the 1-2 punch of wine and woman, he slowly turned to look over his shoulder. Patience was standing beside the little round table, dressed in a carnelian-colored robe with a wide hood.
Oh, come on, Locke growled. Not now! Surely you have better things to do than bother us now!
Which one are you? Said Sabitha, calmly and respectfully.
Arkadama Patience. You work for my rival.
Patience, said Locke. If this isn't important, I swear to the crooked warden I'll—
It is important. In fact, it's critical. It's time we spoke. Since neither of you could be dissuaded from this foolishness, both of you have a right to know.
Both of us, said Sabitha.
What do we have a right to know? Where Locke really comes from.
Patience gestured for the two of them to move away from the food table.
And what Locke really is.
Interlude. Happenings in bedchambers. 1.
Honored cussing, Locke hissed. I need...
Do regale me with your needs, said Bulidazi.
The iron pressure against Locke's neck eased just enough to permit a breath.
It's not what you think, he gasped.
Perhaps I've been an idiot, whispered Bulidazi, but you'll not find me eager to resume the role.
Gennaro!
Sabitha stood in the balcony door, and her tone of voice was sufficient to check a rampant horse. Bulidazi actually lowered his blade.
Verena, I'm sorry, but your behavior...
It's your behavior that requires explanation, cousin.
I've been listening to both of you.
You've been skulking like a thief.
You proclaimed love for one another. I heard your quarrel.
Too late, Bulidazi seemed to remember that he hadn't yet professed his interest in Verena to Verena herself. Dismay spilled across his face like paint splashed across a blank canvas, and Sabitha didn't neglect the opening.
It was an acting exercise, you lout, an improvisation, and why should it concern you, were it otherwise?
An improvisation?
I asked Lucasa to follow my lead and improvise a scene.
She pushed Bulidazi's arm firmly away from Locke's throat.
A scene you interrupted. We might be the ones dressed as commoners, Baron Bulidazi, but you've bested us for coarse behavior.
But...
Locke admired the ingenuity of Sabitha's ploy, but perhaps she was pushing it too far. They needed Bulidazi controlled, not crushed. It was time to resume his role as advocate. He rubbed his aching throat.
Cousin Verena, he coughed. What Gennaro means is that I told him about my own betrothal. So, when he overheard our exercise, why, he had good cause to suspect some deceit.
He had no cause to lay hands on your person.
Cousin, be sensible. We discussed this before we set out. We knew that living incognito would require us to surrender some of the dignities of our true station.
Yes, but furthermore, there are no other witnesses, so I feel no need to require satisfaction.
Locke tried to sound as natural and confident as possible, though he suspected Bulidazi would rate the prospect of a duel with him as a physical threat on par with a difficult bowel movement. The thought of alienating Verena, however...
I seem to have made a mistake. Bulidazi sheathed his knife. The cold anger of moments before was put away just as thoroughly. Verena, I apologize for the misunderstanding. Tell me, please, how can I recover your good opinion?
Locke blinked at the solitary direction of the apology and the rapid shift to a smooth, wheedling manner. He'd pegged Bulidazi as sincere and straightforward, even a bit of a yokel, but the Asparan had obviously relegated the noble Lucaza to the role of a tool in his designs on Sabatha. That and his ease with violence hinted at dangerous depths.
For one thing, said Sabatha, you can cease this unseemly scuttling in shadows. You're a lord of Aspara and the patron of this company. I'd prefer to see you come and go openly in a manner befitting your blood.
Of course.
And if you want to make yourself genuinely useful, you could secure us a more appropriate rehearsal space. I'm growing tired of Mistress Gloriano's inn-yard.
Where would you prefer?
I'm told we're to use a theatre called the Old Pearl.
Oh, naturally. Well, that's just a matter of a gratuity for the Countess Envoy of Ceremonies.
See to that gratuity, Baron Bulidazi, said Sabatha, subtly softening her posture and tone of voice. Surely it's a matter of little consequence for you. It will be a boon to the company to be practicing on our real stage as soon as possible. Do this, and I'll be pleased to call you Gennaro again.
Then consider it done.
Bulidazi bowed to her with gallant over-formality, gave Locke a perfunctory clap on the shoulder, and went away in haste. His footsteps receded down the passage, and the door to the inn's second floor banged shut.
That was close, whispered Locke. Our patron is starting to assume possessive feelings toward his noble cousins, said Sabatha. He's more shifty than I realized.
My neck agrees.
With the threat of Bulidazi temporarily quelled, Locke's thoughts returned to the conversation the Baron had interrupted.
And, look, you and I have had...
Nothing, hissed Sabatha. Evidently I was wrong to say what I did, and wrong to feel those things in the first place.
That's bullshit!
Barely feeling the ache across his throat for the new sting of her words, Locke shocked himself by grabbing her arm and pulling her back out onto the balcony.
I tripped over something. I don't know what it is, but you owe me an explanation. After everything we just said to one another, I will not let you push me aside just because you're pitching a fit.
I am not pitching a fit.
You make the Sansas look like bloody diplomats when you do this. I'll run after Bulidazi and pick another fight with him before I'll let this rest.
What set you off? You cannot be so wholly ignorant. Do you know what they pay for red-haired girls in Jerem? Do you know what they do to us if we're pristine? The thief-maker did, and it's so awful it was too much for his conscience. Understand? That ghoul would tongue-fuck a dead rat if there was silver in it for him, but selling redheads was too vile. He's the one that taught me to keep my hair dyed and wrapped.
I've heard about these things, but I never thought of you.
First they cut, said Sabatha, right out of a girl's sex. What they call the sweetness, the little hill. You've been around Carlo and Galdo long enough. You must have heard a dozen names for it. Then, while the wound is gushing, they bring in the old bastard with the rotting cock or the festering sores or whatever he wants miraculously cured, and he does his business. Blood of the blood-haired child is what they call it. Sabatha! And then, even though most of the miracle is already used up, they bring in the next 100 men that want to go at the bloody hole, because it still brings good luck. In fact, it's especially good luck if you're the one riding her when she finally dies. Gods! Yes, may they all spend 10,000 years drinking salted shit in the deepest hell there is.
Sabatha slumped against the rear wall of the balcony and stared at their discarded wine cups and scripts.
Damn! I am pitching a fit. You have some cause. She gave a sharp, self-disgusted sort of laugh. How was I supposed to know all this the first time I ever laid eyes on you? Said Locke. I remember that first glimpse as though it happened yesterday. But that's not the only thing I think about, if it really bothers you that much. My hair doesn't bother me, she said forcefully. It's the stupid bastards who'd put me in chains on account of that nonsense about it. I've had to mind this every day of my life since I went to Shades Hill. Every day. All the hours I've wasted peering at my hair in a glass, slopping it with alchemy. Some day I'll be old enough that it won't matter any more. Some day not soon enough. What about before Shades Hill? Nothing before the hill matters, she said quietly. I was protected. Then I was an orphan. Leave it at that.
As you prefer. Slowly, hesitantly, he leaned against the wall beside her. Stars were just beginning to pierce the bruise-colored sky above them, and the faint, familiar whispers of evening were rising, the hum of insects, the clatter of wagons, the din of eating and laughter and argument.
I'm sorry, Locke, she said after a few moments had passed. It's stupid and unfair to be so upset with you. I've insulted you.
Absolutely not. He put one hand on her arm and was encouraged to find her resuming the habit of not flinching away. I'm glad you told me. Your problems should be our problems, and your worries should be our worries. You realize how rarely you bother to explain yourself?
Now that's a load of straight truth. You could give inscrutability lessons to the god's damned Eldrin.
You know, it's sort of frightening how you're actually starting to make sense.
Is that meant to be complimentary?
Maybe toward both of us, said Locke. Her weather-like mood swings, the brief seasons of warmth followed by withdrawal and frustration, her urge to control everything in her life with such precision and forethought, behavior that had mystified Locke for years suddenly had a context. I honestly don't care what color your hair is as long as you're under it somewhere.
You forgive me for being unreasonable?
Haven't you forgiven me for the same thing?
We may find ourselves once again in serious danger of a happy understanding, she said, and the way her smile reached her eyes made Locke's pulse race.
Suddenly they seemed to be competing to see who could bring their lips closer to the other's without appearing to do so. The sound of a rapid, careless tread echoed from within the passage, and they sprang apart in instinctive unison. The passage door slammed open, and Alondo Razi stumbled out, red-cheeked and sweaty.
"Alondo," said Sabitha with plainly exaggerated sweetness, "would you consider yourself at peace with the gods?"
"I'm sorry," he panted, his voice slurred. "I don't mean to barge in on you, but I can't find Giovanno. It's the Asino brothers. Need help." "Don't tell me they started a fight," said Locke, straining to banish the sudden mental image of a Sansa insulting Lord Bulidazi and all the intersections of flesh and steel that might result.
"No, gods, no. Sylvanas bet they couldn't chug the ash bastard. Nobody can chug the ash bastard. So they tried and got what was coming. Ha!"
Locke seized Alondo by the sweat-stained collar of his tunic and briefly forgot that the Asparan had half a decade of growth on him.
"Razi," he growled. "What the cock-blistering hell is an ash bastard?"
"Come down," said the unsteady young actor. "Best see for yourself." Locke and Sabitha followed him to the common room, where they found the company and the evening ale-swillers even more scattered and dissipated than usual. Carlo and Galdo were lying on their sides, artfully symmetrical, in the middle of a slick black-red puddle. The smell in the air was somewhere between wet animal fur and an unwashed torture chamber, but all the non-Sansa onlookers were quivering with mirth. Mistress Gloriano was the only exception.
"I said take it out to the yard, idiots! Pink-skinned Therin infants!"
She noticed Locke and Sabitha and encompassed them with her glower.
"What kind of fool tries the ash bastard indoors?"
"What the hell are you people talking about?" said Locke.
He knelt beside Carlo. The twins were alive, though they were liquored out of their wits and had clearly lost a fight with those potent joint antagonists, vomit and gravity.
"The ash bastard," said Jasmer, who was leaning against a nearly comatose Sylvanas, "is that ghastly spittoon."
Locke glanced where Jasmer pointed and saw a tar-coloured cask about 2 feet long resting sideways on the floor. The stuff spilling from it looked like campfire ashes after a hard rain. "It's a quaint ritual of the house," smirked Jasmer.
"Performed in the yard!"
bellowed Mistress Gloriano. "True enough, but the gist of it, dear Lucasa, is that the bastard collects tobacco ash and spit for weeks when people remember not to use the floor. We test the mettle of brash young picklewits like your friends there by challenging them to chug the bastard, which means we fill it to the brim with a hideous black juniper wine Mistress Gloriano imports directly from hell. We swirl it around and make them drink the slurry."
"That's idiotic," said Sabitha,
who was making sure Galdo still had a pulse.
"Completely," laughed Jasmer. "No one in the history of the company has ever chugged the ash bastard without hucking it right back up. And lo, the bastard is victorious once again."
"Jasmer," said Sabitha, lowering her voice, "not to put too fine a point on it, but we need these two unpoisoned if they're going to keep rehearsing. In fact, we need everyone. Can't you idiots dry out a bit?" Sylvanus, though he seemed barely aware of the existence of his own face, let alone the world beyond it, gave an elephantine snort.
"Green gills or no," said Jasmer, "the company always takes the stage, my dear. Besides, this can hardly even be called a proper debauch by our lofty standards. Your friends hold their liquor like sieves is the problem."
"Sorry to make this your trouble," said Alondo, sinking into a chair, "but we needed some help with the floor and moving the Asinos, and we're all too blotted to be much use, and we can't find Genora or Giovanno. Hey, did you two see Lord Bulidazi? He was here too."
"We know," said Sabitha. "Mistress Gloriano, we need some water buckets. Lucasa, we'd better drag these two out to the yard and get to work. They'll be stuck to the floor like barnacles if we let them alone."
"I was going to thank you again for prying me out of Bully Darcy's grasp," whispered Locke, "but now I think I'll wait and see how the evening ends first."
"How do you think I feel?" She squeezed his arm and flashed him a hint of a smile, like a fellow desert traveller sharing out precious water. "Now, pick arms or legs. Let's heave this one outside."
"Where the hell is Giovanno?" muttered Locke.
2. Jean had watched Locke ascend the stairs, skin of wine in hand, with a mix of relief and annoyance. It was past time for Locke and Sabitha to sort themselves out, or pitch themselves out of a high window. Jean's own peace of mind would be the benefactor in either case. He closed his eyes, leaned his head back, and let the wall do the job of holding it up for a moment. What a time he must be having, when merely sitting alone and not pretending that his bruises didn't hurt felt like an immoderate indulgence. When he opened his eyes again, Genora was smiling at him from 2 feet away.
"I've found a threadbare boy," she said. "Let me help you back up to your room."
My room?"
"Trust me," she said, hauling him to his feet. "Until the rest of the company's too drunk to move, you never want to be the first to fall asleep around 'em. Gods know what mischief you'll wake up to."
There was a strange heat on his cheeks, like the warmth of too many ales. Genora's hand was around his waist as though it were the most natural thing in the world, and together they made a quick exit from the common room.
"So what are you not telling me, Giovanno?"
She closed the door to Locke and Jean's chamber softly, then put her arms on his shoulders.
"Not telling you?"
"Oh, come now."
Her fingers began to work the knots between his shoulder blades.
"You read, write, and figure, but scribes don't get muscles like this pushing quills. I know you speak Vadrin as well as Theron. You can handle a needle and thread. You fought a grown man to a standstill. Not just any man, but Bert. Bert's a scrapper and a half."
"I've had a strange education," said Jean, feeling his wits loosening as agreeably as his muscles under Genora's ministrations.
"You're all strange, Yukimori, and strangely educated."
"It's nothing sinister. We're just..."
"Slumming, hmm? Isn't that what they usually call it when someone dresses down and plays beneath their station?"
"Genora!"
Jean turned around, grabbed her hands, and halted the massage. His well-soothed wits grudgingly rose to the occasion. If she'd been snooping on them, a flat denial would probably be useless.
"Look, imagine whatever you like, but please believe me, everyone is better off just taking things at face value."
"Is there some sort of danger in my being curious?"
"Let's just say there's absolutely no danger in not being curious."
"Rest easy. It's an informed guess, Giovanno. Your cousin Lucasa, well, he seems a little surprised every time he notices that the world isn't revolving around him. And Verena, she's no scullery maid, you know. Manners, diction, learning, poise. Then there's swordsman's calluses on these hands of yours." She ran her fingers lightly over his palms, and the sensation made Jean's blood run hot in more than one place. "The gods put you all together from odd parts. There's a story to be told."
"There isn't. There are so many trusts I'd be breaking. Genora, please."
"All right," she said soothingly. "I can live with a bit of mystery. Let's work on what ails you, then."
"What ails? I don't... Oh, well, ha."
She slipped her hands under his tunic and ran them up his back, where they started to gently but firmly put his sore muscles into something resembling their proper order. This had the natural effect of bringing them together. Her breasts were warm against his upper chest, and her lips were parted in a half-smile just in front of his nose.
"Heh!"
She blew playfully on his optics, fogging them over.
"Not frightened of older, taller women, are you?"
I wouldn't really know what to be frightened of."
"Oh? So you're an untapped vintage, hmm?"
"Genora, I'm not used... Surely you can see that I'm not thought of as, you know."
"You know what I don't like, Giovanno?"
She moved her hands and teased the thin line of hair that ran down his stomach.
"Stupid men, weak men, illiterate men. Men who can't tell a play from a pile of kindling."
Their lips came together, and as they kissed, she slowly, deliberately guided one of his hands until it rested atop a breast. She squeezed for both of them, pushing his fingers, and Jean felt his awareness of the world narrowing to the delightful corridor of heat that seemed to be rising between them.
"Lucasa," he whispered, "he might..."
"I have a feeling your friends are going to be up on the roof for a very long time," she murmured. "Don't you?"
Soon enough, by some process halfway between legerdemain and wrestling, their clothes were off and they fell into his bed. Jean could barely tell where light skin ended and dark skin began. He lay wrapped in the taste and smell and warmth of her, with smoke-colored hair falling around him like a teasing shroud. Genora seemed very much at ease taking the lead, staying on top of him, alternately slowing and quickening the rhythm of their coupling. All too soon he reached the limit of his untrained endurance, and with a joyful, aching eruption there was one less mystery in Jean Tannen's life. Exhilarated, exhausted, and pleasantly bewildered, he clung to her for some time as their heartbeat slowed from a gallop to a canter. The pains of his tussle with Bertrand the Crowd seemed 100 years in the past. Genora found her jacket in the mixed scatter of their clothing, pulled out a slim wooden pipe and tamped it full of a tobacco mixture that smelled alien and spicy to Jean. They covered the room's feeble alchemical globe and shared the pipe back and forth in the near darkness, talking softly by the orange glow of the embers.
"So I really was your first."
"Was it that obvious? Would you have known, even if I hadn't said?"
"Enthusiasm is the first step," she said. "Artfulness comes later."
"I hope I didn't disappoint you."
"I'm not displeased, Giovanno. Hells, having a lover that's new to the dance means you can train him properly. Give me a few nights and I'll have you whipped into proper form."
"The Asino brothers, they always, well, they always invited me to go with them when they went out. To buy it, you know."
"There's no shame in doing that, and there's no shame in not having done it. But those two are hounds, Giovanno. Any woman could smell it a mile away. Sometimes a run with the hounds is just what you're in the mood for, but in the end they'll always roll around in muck and shit on your floor."
"Oh, they've got an endearing side," said Jean. "It comes out once a month when the first moon is full. They're like backwards werewolves.
Well, she said, when I take someone into my bed, I prefer brains and balls in more equal proportion.
I like the sound of that. Hey, there's a... Sorry, beneath your legs, did we...
Ah, my apprentice, allow me to introduce you to the concept of the wet spot.
Is that uncomfortable?
Well, it's not what I'd call ideal. Hey, what are you...
With an enthusiastic excess of groping and giggling, he applied his strength to shifting their positions. In a few moments, he'd pushed her to the dry side of the bed and taken her former place.
Hmm, Giovanni, you have a gallant streak. Another smoke?
Absolutely.
They were just finishing carefully lighting the second bowl when the door burst open.
Giovanni! Shouted Locke. It's the Asino brothers! You wouldn't believe what they... Oh, my gods, holy shit!
He stared for a second or two, then whirled away and faced out into the hall.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize... The idiot twins, said Jean. Are they in trouble?
No, said Locke, with less than believable haste. No, no, no. Actually, it's not important at all. We've got it handled. You just...
Hell, I can sleep in the common room. You two just forget I exist. Sorry. Have a good time.
We are, said Janora,
calmly exhaling a line of smoke.
Great. Well, excellent. Just going now.
He's down off the roof a lot sooner than I would have thought, said Janora once the door was closed again.
Yeah, said Jean, frowning. Something must have happened. Whatever the Asinos did.
Your friends, said Janora. They sort of look to you to hold them together when there's trouble, don't they?
Well, that's a pretty flattering way of putting it, but...
Let 'em fend for themselves for a night, she whispered. Now we'll have privacy. If Verena wants to sort Lucasa out, she can always take him to my room.
She can, said Jean. She sure as hell can. So, is it too soon to start hearing about this artfulness you mentioned?
3.
Long summer of the Therin throne, shouted Carlo, arms outflung to encompass the inn-yard. Ordained time for building and growing, while earth and sky are generous. These years for princely Orin lie fallow as a field, ploughed and yet unseeded with valor.
Carlo lurched to his knees and ended what had been a fine, vigorous declamation by vomiting. Locke, watching from the shade of a wall, put his hands to his forehead and groaned.
"Gods above," said Moncrane. "I've seen songbirds with more iron in their gullets than you, Camori. One dance with the Ash Bastard, and you're acting like you've been killed in the wars. Understudy!"
Galdo, his complexion a shade green in its own right, seemed uninterested for once in making sport of Carlo's discomfort. He stepped forward and placed his hands on his brother's shoulders.
"I can do it. I'm fine," panted Carlo.
He spat and wobbled to his feet.
"Like hell, idiot," said Galdo. "Here's a thought. Let's do it together." "What do you mean?" "Toss it back and forth."
Galdo faced Moncrane and spoke with the precise tone and volume of his twin before the stumble.
"Swords unblooded hang in scabbards unworn, and sun-like in its dispensations the imperial court sheds grandeur on the world." "Sweet summer of the Therin throne," said Carlo, interrupting smoothly, conquering his wobbly knees and willing the hoarseness from his throat. "Some that live as beggars within would scorn to live as dukes without. Such an empire it is, and some wear stolen splendor with the dignity of right-born kings. Below the streets, the skulkers, the cousiners, the vagabonds of fortune raise bold business in catacomb kingdoms unknown to honest daylight. If thieves pretend to eminence," said Galdo, "and meet in eager regiments, defying rightful law and crown, is it not suiting to the temper of the age? So high the tides of fortune rise beneath the Therin throne, its outlaws pay tribute with matching insolence."
"Matching insolence," said Moncrane. "That'd be you Asinos.
Hold, everyone, hold. This is all very pretty. Why don't we just dispense with the notion of parts altogether? We can stand on stage in a group and chant the lines for all the roles. Hells, we can even hold hands to keep our spirits up while it rains rocks and vegetables on us.
I rather liked it, said Chantal.
As if I gave a... She's right, Moncrane. Sylvanus stirred, emerging from the shade as well as his usual torporous morning fuddle. How often do you see a pair of twins on stage? We should make something of it. We've got precious little spectacle as it stands. When we're in want of spectacle, Andrassus, I'll start walking around without my breeches. You useless seresti coxcomb! Think on it! Twins for a chorus! Something never seen before! To let the peons know they're not watching old Father Dullard's piss-weak boredom revival, but a proper something from the Moncrane Company!
Actually, it's the Moncrane Bulidazi Company these days, said Chantal.
Any time you want to return to being an ambulatory pair of tits, turncoat, you can mince straight back to Basanti and ask how many lusty maids are still on offer.
Locke noticed that Moncrane's shoulders sagged, despite his tone of voice. However the impresario might ridicule Sylvanus, the old lush had occasional sway over him.
Ah, gods, past the third or fourth row of groundlings, who can tell their twins anyway?
It's what they do with their voices, said Alondo. You have to admit it's good when they're not pitching vomit everywhere.
We've got to do something about their hair, said Moncrane.
Glue a wig on Baldy, said Carlo.
Hold the fop down and shave him, muttered Galdo.
Hats, said Sabatha in a politely commanding tone. They can both wear hats. It's a question of costuming.
And that would require the attention of the costumers, rumbled Moncrane. I'm sure they're off somewhere attending to clothes at this very instant, but whether they're taking them off or putting them on is the question. Moncrane!
A stout middle-aged Therin strolled into the inn-yard. He had no chin to speak of, and long hair so ill-kept it looked as though a brown hawk had perched on the back of his head and clung there until it died.
Jasper, you lucky bastard! I didn't believe them when they said you were off the hook. How many cocks did you have to lick to get them to slip the chains?
Master Calabazi, said Moncrane, you know a gentleman never does his own dirty work. I simply made a lot of promises concerning your daughters. Or was it your sons? Gods know I can't tell them apart.
Ha! Ah, if you're a gentleman, I fart incense. But you're out, and now someone's conjured a wild fantasy about you playing the pearl. Is this the show, a little one?
It's not the size, but the employment, said Moncrane, losing some of his forced good cheer. Why are you bothering me?
Well, you know what me and my lads need.
Speak to Genora, she's the woman of business.
Well, I thought with that fancy new owner you've got, you might lay a surety.
Patron, Calabazi, we've got a noble patron, not a new owner. And you wouldn't get a surety if Emperor Salarius himself crawled out of his tomb to watch the show. You get paid when the rest of us do, on performance nights.
It's just that there's some, uncertainty in your situation, and we'd like something firmer than a heartfelt assurance we'll be working. I was in jail for 2 days, you idiot. I didn't breathe Wraithstone smoke and lose my wits. If you want the work, you can have the usual terms, and if you don't, I won't lie awake at night wondering where I'll get 3 or 4 half-wits to shovel shit.
The two men moved chin to chin and continued arguing in low, impassioned tones. Locke gestured to Alondo, who was lounging nearby, and whispered,
"What's this?" "It's the trenchman, Lucasa," Alondo yawned. "The Countess might be pleased to hand out the old pearl for shows, but she doesn't pay to keep the place clean. We do. That means empty trenches for a few hundred to piss in every night, dammed up and tended by apes like Calabazi.
This whole thing is more complicated than I ever imagined. Too true. And Jasmer hates the business side of business, you know. He negotiates like he's having his balls scraped. Across the inn-yard, Jasmer brought the conversation with Calabazi to a halt by raising both palms to the ugly trenchman's face and turning away.
"Master Moncrane!"
shouted yet another newcomer, appearing from the direction of the stables. Moncrane whirled.
"God's peace, you fucking fool! Can't you see I'm work—"
"Oh, gods, Baron Bulidazi, I didn't recognize you. You've, come in costume again."
"Ha! Huh. I wanted to be in keeping with the spirit of our endeavors."
Bulidazi, once again dressed in a low fashion, wore a dirty broad-brimmed hat that partly concealed his features,
"and, of course, to intrude as little as possible on your affairs."
"Of course,"
said Moncrane, and Locke was certain he could hear teeth grinding even from across the inn-yard.
"And who's this? Anyone important?"
I'm Parza Calabazi, sir. I handle—"
"No, not important, or you'd know it's my lord. Go be undistinguished somewhere else."
Yes, my lord."
Locke frowned as he watched Calabazi all but scuttle away. His original impression of Bulidazi seemed more naive than ever.
"Now, Moncrane,"
the young lord gave the impresario a firm slap on the back,
"I know this inn-yard has a certain unrefined charm, but I've arranged for better surroundings."
"The old pearl?"
Moncrane made a visible effort to swallow his resentment.
"Is it ours, my lord?"
"We can rehearse there commencing tomorrow, and we'll get 2 days of actual performance. The envoy of ceremonies is a family friend. I'll even post the man to make sure that you're not pestered by the Parza Calabazis of the world."
"That's, well, I suppose that's very generous, my lord patron. Thank you.
Think nothing of it. It's in my own interest, eh? Now, what's the scene?"
There's no scene, my lord. We, need a break, I think. Arguing with Calabazi."
"Nonsense. You're no man to be tamed by a mere argument, Moncrane."
Bulidazi mimed a fist crashing into his own jaw, a gesture that made Moncrane plainly uncomfortable.
"What did you last practice?"
"Nothing of real consequence."
"The scene, goddamn you!"
Six. Act One, Scene Six. We were just nailing down the situation of the chorus. "Vagabonds of fortune raise a bold business in catacomb kingdoms unknown to honest daylight," said Bulidazi. "I like that one. But that means Amadine's about to come out for the first time. Surely you won't stop now."
"Well, perhaps not."
"Yes, perhaps not."
Bulidazi settled into the chair that Moncrane had occasionally rested in while watching the morning's work.
"Mistress Verena, might I beg a few moments of your Queen of Shadows?"
"Why, my lord Bulidazi, your attention is always very welcome," said Sabatha with a perfect curtsy.
Locke would have sworn he felt the blood congealing in his heart, and he fought to maintain a facade of dopish complacency.
"Thieves in place for Scene Six!"
shouted Moncrane. Bert the crowd hurried into the middle of the yard and was met by Carlo and Galdo, who were intended to join the spear carriers for several mob scenes after finishing their orations. Moncrane had promised to hire a bevy of bit players to flesh out the crowds, but didn't seem to want to start paying them too early in the rehearsal process.
"Well met, my noble peers and bastards! Well met at Barefoot Court!"
Chantal advanced from her side of the inn-yard, hips swaying, arms outthrust, playing to the tiny crowd.
"What stirs, you ragged suitors, to bring you hence from drink and dice and warm attentions?"
"Allegiance, fair Penthra," said Bertrand. "Allegiance, fair and fallen lady, for she that claims our deep regard makes those comforts seem cold distractions."
"Valadon, you ever were a wool-tongued devil. Now here's the air hung with silk. What makes the change?"
Chantal touched her husband playfully on the chin.
"My mistress and yours," said Bertrand. "Her goodness puts a sting to my conscience. I have been remiss in my tributes and must amend my courtesies."
"So would we all,"
said Carlo.
"Henthra, let her come forth. She has sheltered us and kindled loyal fellowship, and even such poor wretches as ourselves must make obedience."
"We are all wretches at our ragged court, and none therefore a poorer contrast."
Sabatha's voice was effortlessly regal as she glided into the scene, out of what would eventually be the shadows of the actual stage. Not even the distraction of Bulidazi could truly dampen Locke's pleasure at watching Sabatha vanish into the role she'd so coveted.
"Grace like fire's heat, I am made ashamed of my tribute," said Carlo, sinking to his knees. "You are Amadeen, called Queen Beneath the Stones, or I was never born. My gift deserves not the name for such a beauty. It pales, and with it my pride. I beg a second chance to steal a more worthy courtesy."
"Indeed, his offering is slight as a passing fancy," said Bertrand. "Be assured of my love, bright Amadeen, and take my tribute first."
"Unkind Valadon, this is no race with lines to cross before all others. Stand easy. Surely a moment's wait can little harm your preparations."
Bertrand bowed and took a step back.
"I am Amadeen, called many things," said Sabatha, gesturing for Carlo to rise. "There is no honour more worthy than this, your gift of friendship. I see you are new among us."
"Many years a thief, mistress, but far too many passed before kind fortune brought me to your company. Oh, let me trade this bauble for something more fitting, or gladly hang for trying."
"Never speak of such an evil," said Sabatha, "and never speak of shame, but give what you have."
Carlo pretended to hesitantly pass something over, and Sabatha mimed holding it up between thumb and forefinger.
"A speck of a silver ring," scoffed Bertrand, "careworn as a scullion's hands."
"I more proudly take a speck from a man with empty pockets," said Sabatha, "than riches from a man whose purse stays heavy. What good thing might not be coined from this courtesy? It shall become bread and wine, and clothing, and sharp steel. It shall harden the sinews of our fellowship, and for that I hold it dear. You are welcome to our band, brother."
"God's willing, I shall never leave it."
"God's willing."
Sabatha held out her other hand, and Carlo kissed it. She turned to Bert.
"Now, Valadon, let's know your heart. Some months you've spent among us, yet aloof, a proud and solitary sort."
"Proud and solitary as yourself, artful Amadeen, though I admit my poor fellowship. Here's the remedy. Oh, how I've strained my talents to produce a worthy gift."
"A bracelet," said Chantal,
as her husband pretended to display it with a flourish.
"Black sapphires set in gold."
"As suits a queen of shadows," said Bertrand. "Pray it please you. I beg you wear it, even once, though you later strike it to a royal ransom of coins."
"Great weight to grace a single wrist. Our thanks, Valadon. Your obscure character is made clear. How did you come by this treasure?"
"3 days and nights of pains," said Bertrand, "watching a great house until I saw my chance for the seizing."
"Will you wear it first, to show me its workings?"
"Why, the clasp is simple, gracious Amadeen. Give me your hand, I shall anoint it."
"I would see this treasure on your wrist ere it touches mine. Or has your deep regard run shallow?"
"This beauty is not meant for such an unworthy display."
"Unworthy indeed."
At a gesture from Sabatha, Chantal seized Bertrand and feigned holding a blade to his neck.
"Ladies, please, how have I offended?"
"Your face is a parchment," said Sabatha, "with treason there written plain. You dread the bauble's touch and the venom of its coiled needle."
She mimed snatching the bracelet and unfolding it for all to see.
"You think us dullards, that by this infant stratagem you might have my life? My spies advised me of your falseness."
"I swear that when I stole the bracelet, I knew not what lay within."
"Stole? Should I not know a thief by every scar and callous of the trade? I have them all, Valadon, familiar as children. Your hands are dough and your sinews slack. This bracelet you had as a gift from your masters."
Carlo and Galdo did their best impression of a general outcry in the crowd, and seized Bertrand by the arms.
"I see now my deception was foredoomed," he whispered. "Clasp the bracelet to my wrist and let justice be done."
"Hasty dispatch is mercy undeserved. You'll have your bracelet back, miscarried murderer, after reflection. Bind him, heat a crucible, and therein cast this scorpion bauble. Past his traitor's lips, pour the molten slurry of his instrument. Aye, gild his guts with melted treasure, then leave him on the street for his masters to ponder."
"I beg you!"
The last plea of the unfortunate Valadon was drowned out by the noise of Carlo once again throwing up. Bert and Chantal hopped backward, minding their feet, while Galdo put a hand to his mouth and went pale.
"Ha!" shouted Bulidazi. "Ha! I think one of your twins has something to feel guilty about, Moncrane."
"Very sorry, my lord," moaned Carlo.
"Perhaps you should try living virtuously for a few days, my friends." Bulidazi rose and stretched. "Well done, despite the sudden ending. Indeed, especially you ladies. By the gods, I think we've got something here. In fact, I'm going to join you at the Pearl for the rest of your rehearsals."
The sudden pain between Locke's temples was a match for the expression on Moncrane's face. 4.
"We'll find our chance to be alone," Sabitha whispered to him more than once.